Welcome back to Elder Sign, a weird fiction podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Brandon Buddha.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. We are back to continue our coverage of the novella The Men from Porlock by Laird Barron. This is from 2011. This is a novella, so we've done a two-parter on this. This is the second part. The first part was the recap, as we usually do it, so this one is going to be the discussion.
Yeah, and once again, just a reminder, this was a commissioned episode, and again, we're so grateful for that. I'm so glad to have read this story and you know, had the opportunity to think about it a little bit and put together a discussion, and I hope you enjoy that too. So thank you to our very generous Patreon supporter who commissioned this episode for us.
Yeah, thank you so much. This story was a lot of fun to get a chance to read. I love doing the episodes with Brandon, but this is also just a really generous thing to do for other listeners of the show as well, who get two extra episodes this month, thanks to your commission. And so we appreciate that, and I'm sure that they do too. We'll say thank you on their behalf as well. But Brandon, we, I think, hinted at a lot of things that we wanted to do in this discussion episode. Last time we talked about story structure a lot. We talked a lot about sentences and paragraphs, thick descriptions, a little bit about fairy tales and Rumpelstiltskin and so on. So my first question for you, Brandon, is where do you want to begin?
Yeah, well, what I really want to focus on in this story, as you said, is the craft. I think this is a nearly perfectly crafted story. As you've already said, Glenn, this story has this deep sense of folklore that also connects to our pretty common nursery tales. It's got supernatural and weird horror. It's got a little bit about worker-employee relations, as well as offering some food for thought about the relationship between cults and exploitative business practices. But one of the reasons why I think the story works so well, and this is where I want to focus here primarily, and hopefully we'll cover all this other stuff through this lens, is that this story has a real symmetry to it. And before we talk about that, though, which we will, let's look at the skin of the story instead of the bones and think about how the superficial elements of the story, the skin of it, I should say, perhaps, is how that is necessary or not to the story's success. So really, the first thing I want to talk about here is the connections that this story has to World War I. What weight, Glenn, do you think Barron gave to setting the story in 1923 and having a bunch of the lumberjacks, or at least our protagonist, be a veteran?
This is the second story of Barron's that we've read, and it is the second story that has this in the background in some way. And I think there are lots of good reasons to do this from a weird fiction standpoint. One of them simply is that this genre that Barron is writing in really comes to fruition in the interwar period. And so setting your stories there is kind of an homage to people like H.P. Lovecraft, Robert E. Howard, Clark Ashton Smith, the people who were publishing in weird tales and more or less invented, or at least brought this type of story into its own publishing category for the first time. So that's very cool. But I also think that the First World War remains for us an episode that we all recognize as having been traumatic. Traumatic to individuals, people like Miller, who were in the trenches shooting people in their capacity as a sniper, listening to artillery shells, seeing comrades killed from various types of brutal weapons, all of that on the personal level. But I think we all also still appreciate and recognize the First World War as something that was traumatic for the entire world, for culture, for society, for not just individuals, but for whole groups, and even traumatic for abstract concepts, if that's a thing that can even happen, right? And so all of that then serves to as a kind of caesura. It's kind of a marker of a before and after, where the world is changed afterwards and people are having to deal with that. If you want to have characters who are traumatized and are attempting to deal with that trauma in some way, the First World War and its aftermath then is a great setting for that type of story.
I also love the way that Barron is kind of playing with the masks, the various literary masks that we see in Lost Generation literature by leaning into characters who really can't escape America after having fought in the First World War, which, you know, the U.S. entered late, and coming home and trying to find their way, not as a writer in France or as a writer at all, but as taking these working class jobs, as having grown up in, as this story indicates, it's like a hillbilly type of place. The trauma of growing up poor, compounded with the trauma of the First World War, compounded further by having to take these jobs because there's no leisure to return to. I think that that is really something that Baron wants to explore in kind of an American fiction sense, is re-looking at some of what we think of as 20s Lost Generation literature. And I really appreciate the way he is setting this, as we noted with what Stephen King does, is kind of reclaiming all of these horror elements for the aristocracy, for the working class.
And setting the story in an occupation that is dangerous and hard work, right? That's really what Baron opens with, is all these grotesque, disturbing images of bodily injuries that people have sustained here on this job. So it's not a job that people should really want to do. I mean, I think lumberjacking is something that we have, well, turned into comedy for one, but also romanticized, right? I mean, like, I've gone backpacking in this part of the world as a leisure activity. So, you know, for me, thinking like this could be my job would be to be out in these woods would be amazing, except that no, it would not. You're going to lose your ear. You're going to get your head crushed. Your teeth are going to get knocked out, that sort of thing. So it's not a job that people would really do unless they feel compelled to for some reason. They can't do something else, can't be around other people, don't feel comfortable settling down in a community anymore. And we get lots of different characters who are bringing different types of that baggage here to the profession. But at the same time, we also here are seeing that Miller can't really escape himself, can't really escape his own trauma. He's teamed up with Casper, who just wants to talk about the war, even though he himself wasn't in the war. He wants to talk about his brother and his home village. And Baron doesn't narrate it, but we can imagine, right, that Miller is on the other side of that big saw, just wishing Casper would shut up. I think that's actually something that Baron shows us through a bit of text without actually explaining to us. And so all of it serves to build this just really awesome mood at the start of the story, where everybody is a little traumatized. Everybody's got some baggage, but everybody's also a little angry with each other too.
Right. It's really amazing. I mean, the way that Baron shows us just what you've described, especially with the relationship to Casper, is that Miller doesn't have Casper come along on the fun hunting trip with the old Spanish-American war veterans and some of the young guys. He asks for Ma, who he can't understand and likes to drink booze. So, I mean, there's that element as well where, yeah, these guys are all trying to escape something. And I wonder then, you know, the prologue is full of characters and descriptions of people who have injuries who we never really meet again. We suggested in the recap episode that, you know, this is meant to humanize these characters so that when Miller returns to the camp and they're all gone, that it's supposed to be a kind of gut punch. But I wonder if you had any other sense of how this prologue is functioning as a way to lead us into the main story. What is Baron doing with this prologue, apart from, you know, giving us that sense of sorrow at the end of the story?
Well, I think also setting the mood and the tone of the whole story, giving us the slow intro, obscuring from us who's actually going to turn out to be the protagonist of the story, obscuring from us at all whose story this really is, which ultimately serves to make this story feel more real, feel more alive, that this is one story among an infinite number of stories, that everybody's got a story. Every character here, every person in this camp is a character in their own story. Here's a little bit about some of them. But then actually, I'm going to take most of that away, and it's just one character who I actually mentioned only very briefly is going to turn out to be the real character by the time that we get to page, you know, 3 or 4 of this story. It is an interesting technique. I think that it works really well, actually, to give us that slow burn and set that mood. I don't think it's something that Laird Barron could have gotten away with. I don't think he would have been able to sell that story if he weren't already Laird Barron at this point.
Right.
I think that, you know, if amateur writers like us submitted this story to the same publication that bought this story, we would have been told to change that opening, because editors at least think that readers want to get right into the story and they want to know what type of story and what the story is immediately. They don't want that slow burn. I don't think that's true, or maybe you and I are just weird readers, but we are readers nonetheless. So
yeah, I mean, I got that note from the editor of Fantasy and Science magazine, of Fantasy and Science Fiction. She said, I really loved this story. I look forward to getting more of your stories. But for me, this story really began at this point, which was about 4 pages into the story that I had written. And I said, well, if you bought the story, I would have considered editing it. You know, I didn't send that email, but in my head, you know, that's the response. And my wife said, why don't you try taking that advice and starting the story, you know, from where this person, from where the editor said. And I said, you do that when they buy the story, you know? But I love the slow burn. I love the prologue. I love the way that in this story, Barron, as you said, sets the tone, but also gives us a sense of the type of language he's going to use in the story to describe the horror that's going to come later. So I feel like this prologue is essential in a lot of ways to the mood of the story, as we've been saying. But it also gives us a way into the setup of the story, which isn't actually the hunting party going out. It's that there's a photographer coming and everyone is supposed to be on their best behavior and probably act like they normally have venison to eat or something. And I get the feeling that because this prologue gives us a sense of how the camp is run and the people in it, that everyone in the camp is going to be expected to play along with this dog and pony show and give, you know, really strong impressions of how the camp runs. And all of this is going to matter, as I said in our recap episodes, because this camp wants to get bought by a bigger outfit. So let's look at the setup here. You know, in one sense, this photographer is the person from Porlock, right? That's our initial sense. This person's going to come and disrupt everything. The band is going to go out and they're going to come back, you know, and it's not going to be a big deal. And the horror element's going to have to do with the camp. But that's not what happens. So because I'm saying that this story really functions on a level of symmetry, which you're free to disagree with, Glenn, by the way, but we're all going along with that premise for the discussion episode here. I want to ask you if you feel that the photographer visit, or the anticipation of the photographer visit, mirrors in any way the hunting band's later intrusion into the secret village. And if you think it does, how does this work for you?
The impending arrival of this photographer is really functioning as the impending arrival of the Uber bosses from Seattle, right? That's the kind of intrusion that this is. It's an intrusion of senior management. And anytime senior management is going to show up, it changes the way that the business or whatever it is that you're doing has to operate. And this is really what I meant when I was comparing this to our experiences in the Army. I was thinking viscerally of when Uber bosses of various types, military and civilian, would show up, you know, in our workspace, and we would actually have to stop working at all. We couldn't do the job because people were coming to watch us do the job. And we had to basically act like something else was the job that we did. It was all very, very strange. And you have that sense here that that's what's going on. And so it's a real intrusion, a real disruption. And that then is mirrored by the hunters themselves showing up in this village. It's the same kind of thing. It's an interruption. It's a disruption, and it has real consequences. Now, to be clear, this village is full of people who are going to be eaten by monsters of some sort and who themselves maybe are also eating babies and definitely are torturing people. So it's hard for me to sympathize with them. I mean, I want to, you know, solidly identify with them as, you know, the working class too, but it's hard for me to sympathize with them.
Yes. I think that it's too dark of a mirror to see clearly the exact reflection in which we'll talk about between like the hunting band and the villagers here. But yeah, I guess they both feel fear management in some way. I guess that's the most superficial way to think about them. I'm not convinced that the cult of the old leech are eating the babies. I think they put them in the cave and expect they'll be eaten by some Ouroboros type figure who never quite eats his own tail. I guess that's an image that I want to look at too, though we didn't really linger on it, and I don't want to spend too much time on it. But that image is the cover of the book that we have. The Broken Circle shows up in this story. We have mentions of Ouroboros, Ouroboros, I guess is one other way to say it. And it's an image where the snake doesn't reach his own tail and I guess devours other stuff between that. So it's an image of maybe total death. I wonder what your sense of that image is.
Well, first I'll just say it's an absolutely gorgeous cover on this hardcover edition that we've got with the trees in the background. I guess really this cover is illustrating this story, which is cool. It's nice that we got to put the image to the story here. But yeah, this whole business with old leech and these multi-segmented creatures in the trees, all this sort of white worm image of the worm Ouroboros is all super creepy. And the worm Ouroboros is famous as the worm that eats itself. And so that suggests a kind of cannibalism. And I do think that you're right that the people in the village are not themselves cannibals, though I think that making the fine distinction between they eat the babies versus they let other people eat the babies, I'm not sure one of those is morally better than the other.
We're not on the cultist team. I mean, there's no right way to, there's no way to morally defend anything that they're up to.
No, absolutely not. But yeah, the whole image here of the cannibalism, or at least of people being eaten, I mean, that is all part of this image. And it's very, very, very disturbing. But then also then to have this symbol that is carved all over these giant trees and then shows up on this book. And then, of course, all of the etchings in the cave, just visually, this story works really well. It's an incredibly visual story that really actually had me clamoring for a screen adaptation of this.
Yeah, I mean, me too. I could not help but read this as a perfect 11 p.m. horror movie, you know, that I just would want to watch the slow unfolding of this story over the course of an hour and a half as it gets past midnight and I'm more prone to being scared, and just have the third act hit at about 12:30 or so, 12 midnight itself, and then just kind of live under a blanket for the rest of the evening. I would love to see this adapted. So I have one more question here for the setup of the story, though we've been kind of commingling a lot of the things that I want to do here. But here's the last question about the skin of the story. Why lumberjacks? You know, why not trappers or a group of brothers, you know? In other words, one way of asking this question is, why do you feel that Baron needed people primarily who didn't know the woods to get lost in them, instead of a group of brothers who have to hunt deer, who live on the outskirts of the old growth forests or something along those lines? What was Baron doing by having this group of intruders on the old growth forest itself kind of have this episode in their lives?
Well, I think that that's even part of the horror of the story, right? Is that, you know, this is a wilderness horror story, which is one of my favorite genres. I'm excited, hopefully, that we'll get a chance soon to do The Willows by Algernon Blackwood, which is really, I think, the mother of all wilderness horror stories. But part of what's happening in this story is that the industrialization of the world, of which the First World War was a horrible, horrible symptom, is continuing to have horrible symptoms. And one of them is the destruction of wild places, the destruction of ecosystems. And that's what's happening here, is the ability, because of machines, to push deeper and deeper into this forest. And one of the things that is horrifying about that is not just the destruction of nature and ecosystems, but is also that there's terrible stuff, horrible stuff in the deep part of this forest that we're only now able to get to because of the machines, but also only need to get to because of the globalization and industrialization of the world's economy. And so I think that's a big part of actually what Laird Barron is doing here. We have seen that as well in Blackwood's Baby, which takes place in this same part of the world and does actually feature wealthy people who are just going off to hunt. Here we're getting really, I think, the other side of that, where we're seeing the workers affected by this as well.
So what you're saying is that this is the exact plot of Fern Gully.
Exactly. It's the exact plot. There's really no differences. Really, really no differences.
One thing that I really love about what Barron is doing with the lumberjacks here, the group of people who on a couple levels are the men from Portlock, they're interrupting the life of an old growth forest and clear cutting trees, which is its own kind of nightmare, explored pretty well in the film Fern Gully, as I mentioned. But is the reliance or the ignorance to local wisdom and folklore? And that's why Bane is such a great character. He's not from this area, but, you know, his grandfather was a preacher who went around and heard stories about it. And one thing I love about these sorts of horror stories, or really any sort of horror story that does this, is when the characters learn about the old wisdoms and the old folklore of an area, and in this case are unable to, because of their work situation or whatever, rather than just being ignorant people who ignore warnings, characters like these are forced to ignore the wisdoms and the old folklores and continue on with their mission, even though they have that spidey sense that something bad is going to happen. And I think Barron carries this off beautifully in this story.
Yeah, everybody knows that something is wrong, but they're all helpless to do anything about it. I mean, this is their job. They've been given orders by the boss. It is the young ones who, of course, also are the keenest. They have the keenest spidey sense here. The old ones who have been, or you know, the oldsters, perhaps I'll say, since old ones mean something else usually on this show. But the oldsters here, right? They think that they are seasoned and grizzled, and in fact, they are seasoned and grizzled, and so don't have that healthy fear that keeps younger people alive here, which I think is just a great juxtaposition as well.
Well, let's move on here and look at some of the actual symmetries that are in the bones of this story. So these guys are banned. They have a pretty miserable life in the lumber camp. It's a deadly dangerous job, as we've pointed out. They can lose limbs. They can lose their lives. They can lose their ears. They're essentially working for a startup that has cut out safety measures even more than usual, so that the company can profit, which means they might profit a little more than if they had gotten a job for a better lumber company. And then our band ends up in a town where a cult of old leech lives, and where our band, you know, in this town can end up losing their limbs or losing their lives or losing their ears. The cult, it turns out, is also an organization that's willing to sacrifice lives to get what it wants. So, two questions, I guess just maybe one. The first one I'll ask is, what's the difference between the cult and the lumber camp at the organizational level?
Well, I'm not sure that there is much of one. And I was really struck by the imagery at the end of this Dr. Kalamov character who ascends into the tree on some kind of thread, like he's a spider. And spiders, you know, pretty menacing image that we use in literature. We talk about characters spinning webs and trapping people in them. Often these are, I don't know, like spy master figures or, you know, criminal masterminds, that sort of thing. And that is definitely I think the sort of character archetype that we get for Dr. Kalamov here, that he is some kind of mastermind or is part of an organization that is a mastermind. They're kind of pulling the strings behind the scenes, maybe really even running the entire world in some way. But that is also true of big businesses, right? That's how to accurately describe the world that we live in now. And it is a world that is being created here in the aftermath of the First World War. I mean, it's already been, you know, started. We've had big robber barons in the 19th century already. But following the First World War, we really get the idea of something that we would maybe call a world order, or new world order, of course, is the scary phrase that we used in the later part of the 20th century, where shadowy rich people are, you know, spinning webs and pulling strings and so on. And that's the image of the most horrifying creature that we actually meet in the story, Dr. Kalamov. And so that's, I think, a parallel with the, you know, lumberjacking, logging industry.
Right. I mean, these parallels here are also that, you know, as I've kind of facetiously been hinting at, they're both willing to sacrifice the lives and limbs of people that are a part of it in order that some might benefit more than others. And so the real question I wonder here is, why do the band of hunters fight to get out of the cult situation instead of saying, oh, we're in this town, you know, yes, if we join this community, we can live comfortable lives, except we have to sacrifice babies. Why are they getting willing to fight to get out of that situation, but are more tolerant of the lumberjack situation where they're saying, yeah, we get to live in this community. It's not quite a comfortable life. Some people might have to be sacrificed, but the ones that live will benefit financially. Why is one situation better than the other for them?
Well, the situation in the village, of course, is explicit, right? You're explicitly going to be doing harm to others rather than implicitly doing it, right? You're going to actually see the babies that you're sacrificing, right? I mean, that's I think, something that I think that that's a real visceral difference. But I think also the parallels do break down a little bit in that because the people in this village are, I mean, they are cattle, right? That's what Kalamov calls them. But what he means by that is that they're making the food, not so much that they are themselves the food, right? And so the people in the village, in some sense, are maybe more akin to the middle management than to the low-level workers, where I think actually the party of lumberjacks who are the men from Porlock in this story actually probably have the closer parallel to these babies who are being sacrificed, and the parallel to the matron and her cronies in the village that they have to fight, the parallel to them is actually probably McGrath.
I think that's absolutely right. And what really jumps out to me here in the difference between the band of hunters and the babies is that this band of hunters can say with some degree of confidence that they've chosen this life and that the babies can't make a choice. But it's clear that this band of hunters is really unable to make choices, right? They were either drafted. This story talks about the draft into World War One. It talks about how these people are desperate to make money so they don't have to live like this anymore. And so there's this illusion of choice that surrounds this band of hunters that when they're confronted, and when we as readers are confronted with this cult that is sacrificing babies, the point of offense, I think, is really that, well, the babies can't choose to be a sacrifice. And yet we're comfortable with the lumberjacks, who are, many of them, choosing to be a sacrifice on some level to capital.
Because there's the illusion of choice there. And it's not entirely an illusion. There are certainly choices that these characters are making to live this life. But the setup of this, of course, right, is that all of these people have something in their background that makes them feel in some way unwelcome in civilization or just unable to be in civilization. And so this is the only place that they can turn to because there just is no other system for them.
Right. I mean, like, they're not helpless, right? These guys are tough, and they're war veterans, and they know how to use an axe, as we see at the end of the story here. The last thing I want to interrogate in this story really is for something we brought up in the recap very briefly, which is the choice in the framing device of the story. Really what I mean here is the asymmetry between the prologue and the coda or epilogue. Glenn, you noted in the recap how the opening of the story introduces us to characters and even brief stories of those characters that we simply don't encounter again. Like, this story really breaks an economy of character rule. And that's something that I'm always on the lookout for in my own writing, because, you know, in a first draft, I often write more characters than I need to and then go back and realize that two or three characters that I've written serve the same function. And so to tighten up the story, I have to combine or erase one of them. But Baron's not concerned with that here at all. As we've said, you know, he gets away with it because this is a prologue and it's all about the setting, and there is symmetry that he brings to it in the main story, but not in the epilogue. So anyway, back to the question at hand. Yes, the prologue has some superfluous elements to it, and the end then ties into the main story, the coda, I mean. So my question for you, Glenn, is what you think about having or changing the frame device of this story, or giving this story a frame device from Miller's point of view, maybe telling a story to his child about why the willow tree is getting chopped down. You know, why not start the story with a frame that really leans into the dark fairy tale and folklore aspect of the story?
Well, I do think that that is a great way to tell this story, or to, you know, tell another version of this type of story. My preference, though, I think, is for what Baron has done here. I like the slow build. I like establishing the setting, letting us see the world a little bit without any real knowledge of what genre we're in or what the themes of the story are going to be, what the horrifying revelation is going to be. I prefer that slow burn to the frame story that gives us all of that kind of as an immediate hook and then takes it away. But interestingly though, as we've talked about before, I think that framing device would be the thing that is more marketable, right? Where all of that is front loaded so that the readers can know that right away. That's a thing that editors are looking for. So I'm actually kind of surprised that Baron didn't do that. And I think you're also right about the overabundance of characters. I mean, this is as many characters as you might get introduced to in a, you know, the first volume of a sprawling 100,000 word, you know, fantasy novel that's the first installment of 11 or something like that, right? And I mean, this is, you know, the truncating, the eliding of characters, taking three characters and turning them into one is something that people are doing all the time when they're adapting those types of books for the screen. Game of Thrones is probably the best example of that. And which I think actually often works a lot better. I was sort of one of the people who was cheerleading those moves. I think most readers of A Song of Ice and Fire were dismayed at those moves for the television adaptation. But I think here I wouldn't want to change a thing. I love that we just get all of these characters and that it feels like the world is full and real to the extent that we can't even tell whose story this is for four pages.
I'm in total agreement with you on that. I mean, I think it would be a disservice to the story to have the prologue and epilogue mirror one another, when I think what Baron is doing as a storyteller is engaging in a project of subverting our expectations, for making us unsure of where the story is going. That at the end, when we get to the coda, we can see that dark fairy tale all the way through the story, and even think that we might have to start chopping down trees in our yards, right? If the shadows are reaching our children's rooms, that we need to get out there with an axe. But starting it where he starts it, with this deep, depressed reality, and then bringing us deeper into the fairy tale, I think is exactly the right way to tell this story. And I don't suggest doing the framing device here. I'm not saying that's a mistake, but I think, you know, looking at marketing a story like this and wondering, okay, like, you know, why, if you're having so much symmetry in the story, don't you do this type of framing device? I think it's because it's a horror story. And the horror works in the story because of the way that Baron has decided to constantly swerve and turn left instead of right or going straight.
But I do think that there is another version of this story that could have been more explicitly a retelling of the Rumpelstiltskin story, right? I mean, you could do that as the kind of dark fairy tale story. This was a thing that was super popular in, well, the 90s. I guess the late 80s, the 90s, early 2000s. Neil Gaiman has done a ton of this. Brent and I have been looking at some of that over on Hanging Out with the Dream King. You and I have read some Angela Carter together, who I think is really the pioneer of this type of move in the 1970s. And yeah, Baron has actually a lot of elements of that in this story, could have written the story more explicitly to be that. I would like to read that story too, but I'm glad we get this version as well.
Yeah, I am too. I'm real, I don't know, keen on this story. I like it a lot. So the last thing I want to do here today is check in with you, Glenn, and see how you felt this story stacked up to the only other Baron story that we've read, Blackwood's Baby. I thought there were some real similarities between this story and Blackwood's Baby, particularly with kind of the using the final girl trope with these rough male characters, seemingly invincible men, which I think is a really fun way to look at plot armor, but also at the final girl trope. But all of that aside, I thought it just might be interesting. I'd like to hear your thoughts on how this story worked for you compared to Blackwood's Baby.
Both of these stories that we've covered have been commissioned, but commissioned by different listeners. But in some sense, they're kind of the same story, which I think is just uncanny and also very cool, right? Both are taking place in the same part of the world, both taking place in the same time, dealing with some of the same themes, each of them featuring cults in the woods and supernatural creatures, each of them also featuring the jeopardy of children. So really the same building blocks, but yet they also at the same time are wildly different stories. And I think that that's fantastic. I think that if you're asking me to rank them or pick one that I'm allowed to read again and the other one I'm never allowed to read again, you know, or something like that, I actually think I probably would go with Blackwood's Baby, because I liked the character of Luke Honey a lot. I really liked the opening of that story that is very hard-boiled, opens as kind of a hard-boiled detective story of sorts. And so that I really, really loved. Though I think that I appreciated the setting writing of this story better.
Well, if you liked Luke Honey and Laird Barron's kind of more hard-boiled detective sensibilities, he does have a series of novels featuring a hard-boiled protagonist. I think they're set in Alaska. And I don't know, maybe we'll get to read one and do a like an Atas-style episode on it one day. If somebody wants to commission that, I'd love to read his hard-boiled writing. For me, this story, The Men from Porlock, completely blew me away. As I said, on so many of these craft levels, that this is the one I would choose again over Blackwood's Baby. Even though maybe it didn't have as strong a protagonist, I'm completely enthralled by Miller's seeming invincibility being baked into this story, and would love to read, I don't know, another story or two about this character. I loved the setting. I loved the slow burn of it. But I think what I loved about it most was, you know, we talked about how visual this story is. I'm not sure it needs an adaptation. I'm not even sure it would be good, but I already saw it in my head, you know? And so that's what I loved about it. This, the feeling of this being a type of horror movie that I love, in the way that Baron was to visually communicate that to me as a storyteller. The story had so many strengths that, if I had to pick one to reread again and one I could never read again, I would choose The Men from Porlock. And I agree with you. The stories are similar. They both have that band getting together element, the bonfire setting, the real bones of the story that you'd expect to see in a group story like this, in a group cast with a singular protagonist. I thought this one worked better personally, though I really enjoyed them both.
Well, if we ever actually end up in some situation where we are each on an island with only one Laird Baron story, my hope is that they're adjacent enough that we can set up some kind of, tin can and wire scenario where we can read each other the story that we have.
That would be the ideal situation, I think. Though never at night. No, sir.
No, sir. No, sir.
Well, I think on that note, that's going to do it for this episode. Once again, I'm Brandon Buda.
And I'm Glenn McDormand. You can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. I do want to say thanks again for this really awesome commission. I want to read more Laird Barron. I wanted to read more Laird Barron after we read Blackwood's Baby, but this one has me yearning for even more. Also has me yearning, frankly, for screen adaptations of Laird Barron, so he'll become more popular. I think that would be awesome. But until next time, we greet you and say farewell.